So, hello, Professor Guerra. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed today, we will be mostly talking about the history of replica symmetry breaking in its broad sense. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you a few questions on background. And
Yes.
first, could you tell us what brought you to be interested in physics and to pursue a PhD in theoretical physics?
Of course, like many people in Italy, in the first day of the universities, the first 2 years I did as engineering, like also Ettore Majorana, for example. And then I found that I was more interested in basic scientific questions, so that I decided to shift to physics. It was the start in Naples at the time. It was 72. There was a start of new big enterprise in physics. In Naples, there was the old Institute of Physics, and they were involved mostly in classical physics, solid state physics, and so on. But then, in the middle of the 50s, the theoretical physicist, my big boss at the time, was Eduardo Caianiello, Eduardo, not Edoardo. In Italian, usually it is Edoardo, but he has the Neapolitan spelling, Eduardo. You know that Eduardo is a famous novel writer, actor in the Neapolitan theater. So he was in Princeton and he won the competition for a full professorship in Italy. And at the end, he was called in Naples. And so he started to develop modern physics, essentially nuclear physics and theoretical physics in Naples, starting from zero, essentially. So in particular, there was advanced school of physics, because it was necessary also to train people who were already graduated, but did not have any exposition to modern physics. So he started some advanced school in physics, and the first lesson, I was a student in the high school, I was not there, but the first lecture was given by Werner Heisenberg in 59. So it was a big, they had a lot of money, and so they could call many good people. I was still in the Lyceum and in engineering. But in 72, I knew that there was this big development in Naples. It was very, very near to my house, so no problem with the moving. And so I decided to go to physics. And in particular, I was interested in theoretical physics, not in mathematics, in theoretical physics with the mathematical methods. There was very, very good teaching. I can tell you that, for example, Gianfausto Dell'Antonio was our teacher in quantum mechanics, and he gave beautiful lectures. I could tell you word by word all lectures on quantum mechanics, the difference, the discrete spectrum, the continuous spectrum, wave packets, observables, and so on. So it was very, very good. And so there were other people also in experimental physics, very, very good, essentially the Rome school, Giulio Cortini. And also Ettore Mancini, important experimental physicist at that time, was called to join the faculty in Naples. Ettore Mancini was one of the, they made a very important experiment with Marcello Conversi, Ettore Mancini, and Oreste Piccioni. They made a very important experiment just after the war. Made a very important experiment such that they discovered that the so-called mesotron, so this this quite heavy particle in the cosmic rays. At the beginning, it was believed that it was the Yukon, so-called, so the particle associated by Yukawa to the nuclear interaction. But they discovered that this mesotron, so the with the nuclear, so it did not participate to nuclear interaction, only to weak interaction. So this was a very, my interconnection is not good. I do not know whether you can hear me.
Well. So you just cut for the last 30 seconds, roughly. So do you want to start again?
Yeah,
you were talking about the mesotron.
I think it is okay.
Okay.
Yeah, the mesotron. The mesotron, they discovered that the mesotron did not interact with the nuclei. So essentially, it was the beginning of elementary particle physics, because the study of these particles began, and it is well known that only after some years, through Yukon particle, the true particle imagined by Yukawa, was discovered in the cosmic rays by Occhialini, Powell, and others. Okay, so Pancini was a professor in Naples, so we had professors who were on the first front in research. So I completed my study. I wrote a thesis, research thesis on the liquid helium, quite good. If one after more than 50 years, it is still essentially correct. It's not completely rigorous from a mathematical point of view, but it is still correct. And then I began the usual career. So I got a scholarship from the fellowship from the National Council of Research. Then I became a researcher in the National Institute for Nuclear Physics, which was a very important institution in Italy, because university did not have so much money for research, essentially nothing at that time. But there was this National Institute for Nuclear Physics, and we could get and some money. I mean, we could go to participate to conferences and so on. So it was quite good. Then I got a professorship, a temporary professorship, like at that time we're called, so that I entered the academic career. I did some work, renormalization theory, and I decided at one end to, at the end, to go abroad. And my idea was Princeton, because in Princeton there was Eugene Wigner, there was Arthur Whiteman, many good people in Princeton. So I wrote to Arthur Whiteman that I would like to go there. And after some time, there was a kind of negotiations, but at the end, I got the position in Princeton. Surely I get great support from Eduardo Gaianiello, but also from Gianfausto Dell'Antonio, who was visiting in Princeton at that time. So I arrived in Princeton, and at that time I was interested in quantum field theory, especially constructive quantum field theory, which was the program of Arthur Jaffe and James Gleam. Very, very difficult, very, very few people involved, but I was able to give some substantial contribution. So Princeton was a very good place. Essentially, I solved some important problem. And during the tea break in Princeton, Arthur Whiteman explained to me what the problem was. And Edward Nelson explained to me one method, without knowing that it could be applied there, one method of so-called Euclidean quantum field theory, so that I took Nelson method and applied to Whiteman problem. So essentially it was just to put together two things. These are miracles in Princeton, because if you stay at tea time and you hear what people are talking, unless you're not completely idiot, you produce good work. So I was able to do good work. I came back to Italy. And after, in the first competition for full professorships, I was able to win this national competition, which was a terrible thing because there were many, many applicants. Consider that at that time, Luciano Maiani, you know, the guy who works, one of the most important scientists who invented all this flavor physics and so on, he was also a candidate. We were young, of course, so even Luciano Maiani at one time was young. And so we participated in this competition. There were enough positions so that I could do it. Then I was, I had to stay in Salerno because I mean, the rules were complicated. So at the end, one should go somewhere. And I arrived to Salerno, small city south of Naples. And then I was called as a full professor in Rome.
Before we get there, if you don't mind. So as you said, you were working in quantum field theory at that point, and for a long stretch of your career. How did you select research questions at that point? Was there a program, or how were you influenced, or
shipping? Quantum field theory, I mean, let's go back a little bit to the 60s. In the 60s, quantum field theory was not very popular. Matrix theory, duality, some rules, I mean, all... why it was not very popular, quantum field theory? Because quantum field theory had great success in explaining quantum electrodynamics. But at the beginning, starting already at the beginning of the 50s, it was clear that there were big difficulties with the strong interaction, so that there was no good result to build a perturbative expansion, for example, for Mason theories and so on. So most people left quantum field theory in favor of matrix theory, duality, and so on. But there were very, very few people who were strongly in favor of quantum field theory that at one point one should find the right way to do. So, for example, Arthur Whiteman at first exploited the route to axiomatic field theory, giving only the general properties based on quantum mechanics and relativistic covariance, trying to build from this axiomatic point of view, field theory good for elementary particles. Of course, quantum field theory was tradition very strong, starting, I mean, from Heisenberg, Dirac in the 20s and the 30s, Yukawa, of course. So very few people in the 60s were still interested in quantum field theory. Arthur Whiteman in prison was one of these, maybe the most important one. But also in Naples, there was Eduardo Gainillo, who had the whole career at the beginning in quantum field theory, and he still went after the renormalization in quantum field theory, trying to build some non-perturbative scheme, even for strong interaction. So I was, of course, his co-worker. He was 20 years older than me, so I consider him one of my important mentors. And I must say that also Gianfausto dell'Antonio, who is only 10 years more than me, was my teacher also in Naples, and he also was involved in quantum field theory. So quantum field theory was the very small number of people believed still in quantum field theory. So Arthur Whiteman shifted from axiomatic quantum field theory to the so-called constructive quantum field theory, so trying to build up the theory by butchering, as it is said, so by putting cutoffs on relativistic quantum field theory, trying to build all correlation function, and then remove, if one is able, remove the cutoffs. Cutoffs typically are infrared, so the system is in a finite volume, and also ultraviolet, so that only quite low energy modes interact. And then you have to remove the cutoff and find this. So Princeton was surely the good place to pursue research in quantum field theory. And this is the reason I decided to go there. And I was lucky because I was supported by Eduardo Gainil and Gianfausto dell'Antonio. And at the end, Arthur Whiteman gave me a job so that I could reach the faculty in Princeton. Marvelous. At that time, it was 70. I had already three young boys, and we were there. And, my boys went to school, so they began to speak English much better than I was able to do. And I said, there, almost 3 years with some interval. So, firstly at the Department of Physics at Princeton University, and then at the Institute for Advanced Study. It was very, very productive. Also, I initiated the collaboration with Barry Mann and Lord Rosen, who were marvelous because they were so smart and they were able to do anything, especially on the mathematical side. So that then I was back at the end. At the end, after some years, I was in Rome.
So at RSB at 4D, right, a couple of years ago, you gave a talk and you mentioned that while you were at Salerno, you invited Giorgio to give a talk to the Institute of Physics. Around 1978, I think. So how did 1978, is that?
Yes.
So how did you
at
know?
At the time, I was in this small university, Salerno, south of Naples.
Yeah.
There were very, very few professors. So automatically, by default, Cainolo was the dean of the faculty, and I, by default, was the director of the Institute of Physics. So I had some money, and I was interested to build good research so that, in particular, I knew that Giorgio Parisi was very, very smart. First time I met him was in 75 in a conference in Lecce, in South Italy. But I knew him in a very good way from what Kurt Simancic told us in a conference in Capri 73. So Kurt Simancic was very, very fond of Parisi, and from what he said, I mean, Capri 73, when Giorgio Parisi made a marvelous career, he had important results, important prizes, appointment, academy, and so on. I was not surprised because Simancic told me that he's very smart. And so I invited him to Salerno. He was involved in spin glass. Spin glass was a terrible problem. not only from experimental point of view, because it is very difficult to work on the experimental sides. There are, from a physical point of view, there are very, very long, there are modes, typical modes, excitation in the system, which are with a very, very long life. So it is difficult even to have a spin glass at thermal equilibrium. But what is important is that the models which were built were extremely interesting from a theoretical point of view. They were essentially frustrated models. They were like a ferromagnet, but in the ferromagnet, different domains try to stay together so that you can get spontaneous magnetization and so on. In these models of spin glasses, essentially famous Sheridan Kirkpatrick spin glass model. It is an infield, but it is terribly complicated. Each spin interacts with other spin, of course, with rescaled interaction. And the interaction can be at random, either ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic. So there is a competition between the sun. And this makes the model terribly complicated. It is very, very simple to write. In any case, I know well that, for example, David Sheridan is very, very proud to have invented this model because it is so a paper has been written in more than, of course, almost 50 years, in more than 40 years on it. So Parisi was very well known for being able to solve important problems. So I came in Altarelli Parisi. So clearly he was involved also in this complex system.
But did you know of this problem and of spinning glasses before he came to give a talk? Was this a problem you were aware of?
No, of course not. Because, you know, we were involved in constructive quantum field theory. And if you take enough cutoffs in the Euclidean frame, we worked in the Euclidean frame, kind of world where time is imaginary, which was very, very, very useful. Very, very useful. So working in the Euclidean frame, quantum field theory is ferromagnetic. So it is also spontaneous magnetization, for example, even in three dimensions. So I was strongly influenced by the idea that at a very small scale, quantum field theory is essentially ferromagnet, so that there can be no frustration, there can be no this kind of complex behavior. In fact, one of the important results of modern theoretical physics is to move from physics essentially treats always quite simple problems, but with the spin glass, you move to complex problems. So what was, I'm sorry. We have to move in physics, we have to move toward complex problems, where complexity has a meaning quite deeper with respect to what is understood in mathematics, in information science, and so on. So that, and this is quite strange, because if you consider humanities, for example, history, or let's say the art of government, the politics, and so on, there complexity is everywhere. Even the basic behavior of the animal, fight or fly. So either to, when you're in some difficult situation, either you fight against other animal or you fly, you run away. And this is based on very complicated, complex. Reasons in favor of flying. I mean, if the animal does not fight, here the connection is unstable. I don't know whether you hear me.
We can hear you.
You hear?
Yes.
Okay. So if the animal does not fight, but he always fly runs away, then he will never eat anything. If he is willing to fight and he is not does not pay to attention such that it would be better than run away, then he is bound to make a terrible mistake, which my friend Miguel Virasoro tells in the following way. If you make the mistake of confounding a tiger with a cat, so you believe it is a cat, but as a matter of fact, it is a tiger, this is a mistake that you can do only once in lifetime. So fight or fly is the first complex system, and this works in the brain of any animal. So we have to learn how simple animals make their reasoning in order to, at the end, to understand the spin glass. Still, we did not do it completely, but there has been a long progress. So I invited Giorgio Parisi to, I knew him in this conference. We had also some discussions on political aspects, because take into account that in Italy, politics is very, very discussed by people involved in scientific research. So he spoke about spin glasses, what was the problem and so on. He still did not have the solution, but he was very, very near. After a few months, suddenly the solution came to his mind. And so we learned a lot of things, very, very important things, that for in the usual case of a statistical mechanics system, like for example, a ferromagnet, you have a very small number of order parameters, typically magnetization, for example. But in the spin glass, you have a big number of order parameters. Essentially, the order parameter in Parisi theory is infinite dimension. So it looks like the Chatelier principle is violated. It's not so, of course, but in any case, order parameter is infinite dimension. And so at the end, Parisi was able to give the solution. Let's talk about the free energy, which is simplest, through variational principle, which is in the opposite direction with the usual variational principle of statistical mechanics, where free energy is lowest among all possible values. And the second principle of thermodynamics will drive the system to the lowest possible free energy, which is the equilibrium. But Parisi variational principle is the opposite. Free energy is supremum, so to speak, for with respect to the order parameter, so that it was said inside the people involved in the field that important result by Parisi was turned out by the referee, who said, no, that's impossible, because in physics, the free energy is the lowest possible with respect to the order parameters. And Parisi found that it is free energy. It is the highest. Free energy is minus log of z, of course. So it's the highest. So it cannot be true. And There was a rumor that there was a referee report telling that these papers by Perry this was after many years. I asked George whether
Sorry,
it was true,
you
and
cut
as a matter of
one.
fact,
So, Francesco, you cut 1 second. So there were rumors that the referee report, and then.
yes. So the rumor was that the referee report was negative, because the guy who was a very good physicist, of course, said no. In statistical mechanics, in physics, essentially in thermodynamics, if you like, a very, very general aspect, the free energy must be the infimum over all possible configuration of the system, taking into account entropy, of course, and energy. Now, Parisi tells us that the free energy spin class is the supremum. Free energy, I mean, minus log of Z, is the supremum, and this cannot be true. So that at the beginning, the paper was not very well appreciated. And I asked Parisi many years after, I asked Parisi, but it is true that you got a negative report, and he said essentially that this was true. So people began to had the difficulties to understand it. And I must say that, first of all, I have been always sure that it was true, but to understand it and to prove it, then this was very, 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 very difficult.
Which brings us to the question. So how closely were you following this work? So he came and gave a talk.
Yes, no, at that time I was working, of course, my field was quantum field theory, so I was working on constructive quantum field theory for a difficult system which were gauge fields, in particular trying to understand the confinement of quarks and so on. And I must say that I began to be very interested in a very active way complex systems and the spin glasses, because inside the spin glasses there is a gauge symmetry. So I said that we know so much about gauge theory in quantum field theory that maybe this will be useful for the spin glasses, which is in fact is true. I mean, many people like Jorge Kurchan studied this gauge structure in a very deep way. So this is so we are at the beginning of the 80s when Parisi had the good idea. He wrote marvelous papers. I always say that it is very, very important to study complex systems and in particular spin glasses, which are a kind of a paradigm, a kind of a basic example. But from a scientific point of view, but also historical, philosophical, and so on, it is also interesting to understand how Parisi was able to solve the the basic problem of this field with the so-called replica method, ultrametricity, and so on. So how he could, in fact, I always, I must say this, we speak among friends, and that I always associated the idea of giving some contribution to spin glasses also with the important task to try to understand how Parisi did reach some results, which is very important. Because if one understands this, then any kind of problem, if one knows the method, so to speak, the method, then I think that the method is very important. The method in general is very important. This is a science, like, of course, Galileo Galilei proves, but we can find a lot of cases. Enrico Fermi, for example, the method of Enrico Fermi is, and also interesting is the method of Ettore Majorana. So not only the results are interesting, but also the method. And so it is, I believe, this is of course is my opinion, you know, that I am not only a friend of Giorgio Parisi, not only admirer, but I think that he really gave an imprint in many, many fields, not only for the results, but also for the method. So we should study results and method. Okay. I don't know whether you would like that I speak about the replica trick.
So,
and the Parisian understanding of the and use of the replica trick.
So if you have insight into the method that got Giorgio to the replica trick, I mean, we understand the physics of the replica trick. That's not necessary for this interview.
The method, Parisi method is very tricky. It's based on physical intuition. There is a very nice sentence of Schiller who says that genius is constantly in contact with nature. I would say in German, but I will write on the the report. So the genius stays constantly in contact with nature. Was the one will promise the other nature will allow. So intuition, you see how things happen. For Galileo, we physicists, all physicists know how to think about what happens. So you can imagine what is, what are the electromagnetic waves, Maxwell equation. This is unstable. You
okay.
Hear?
Yes.
Okay. So we can imagine the Maxwell equation because there is the movement of the electric field will produce a movement in the magnetic field and vice versa. At the end, you have waves. Our intuition about the complex systems is much, very much, much consider how difficult it is to have, for example, make a side remark, how difficult it is to have a theoretical understanding of medicine, for example, medicine. Of course, the physicians, they are scientists. I mean, in a broad sense, they are scientists. They know that if you have some disease, then you can cure using some chemicals so that you arrange the effects of the disease. But since the system is complex, of course, the cure will make other possible, will have other consequences and so on. So there is a whole problem of medicine, which is the science which studies the medical counter effects of chemicals and so on, iatrogenic studies. So there are people who are very, very extreme. They think that all diseases have a iatrogenic origin. You can read in the old historical, all the books of medicine, you can read that, for example, when there was the Spanish disease in 1980, this was terrible, of course, Spanish flu. This was terrible because it was extremely hit very strongly, very healthy young people, the soldiers at the end of the Second World War. But surely there was help from new medicine, which has been involved, which was considered miraculous, and this is aspirin. Aspirin was considered miraculous, and some people gave the advice to use a big amount of aspirin to go back to fight this Spanish flu. In some cases it was a disaster. So there is a complexity there. Use aspirin, which is very, very useful in some cases, but in some other cases can be dangerous. So Parisi, first of all, is not his merit, of course, maybe more the mother or the father of the merit. He has a brain. He was in possessed in received from nature a brain which has a kind of intuitive understanding of complexity. Of course, I speak in modern terms. So. How happens this? I do not. This, of course, I do not know. Then, at that time, and even later, Parisi had other very, very good ideas to exploit numerical simulations. I mean, you know that he also, Nicola Rabibbo, was involved in the APE project to build a big computer for elementary particle physics, statistical mechanics, and so on. But when you use a computer simulation, you get some results, but he was able to see inside the numerical simulation some understanding, ordering, so to speak, so that he could build, but of course by intuition, but also by solid scientific thinking, he could build some quantitative, qualitative, and quantitative very important behaviors from a computer simulation. I'm sure that, for example, ultrametricity came from this line. I mean, if you make a numerical simulation, you never find, of course, ultrametricity because these systems do not evolve in a very slow way. But you can find something which will be the beginning, so to speak, of ultrametric behavior that at the end you find through the analysis of the system, mathematical or physics analysis of the system. So Parisi method is based on mixing of physical intuition and the proper understanding of numerical simulation is what always I have thought. Since I am not very good in numerical simulation and physical intuition is what it is, mostly Galilean, or Fermi, or Majorana, so to speak, Then I was obliged to resort to something which is also strong, which is mathematical rigor. In fact, I tried to attack interesting physical problems with the mathematical rigor. Not mathematics for the sake of mathematics. This is not very interesting, but mathematics to understand the structure of systems, in particular a complex system.
So can I ask you a question about this? So in the 80s in Rome and in Italy in general, there was a quite strong mathematical physics community. So do you know,
yeah.
Do you know how the mathematical physics community responded to the solution of Giorgio? And so it seems that you I think you were the only one at the time to start working or to consider working.
Yeah,
on
yeah, yeah. But
so why other people did not think
this
about
is very interesting. This is very interesting question because there is history. Interesting history of mathematical physics in Italy. Very, very interesting. I recall very few aspects of this because it is interesting. So mathematical physics was very, very serious enterprise. Let's say even consider the 20s, for example. So there were very, very good people like Vito Volterra, Levi Civita, and all mathematical school, Ricci Curvastro, and so on. If you look at the papers of Vito Volterra, they are extremely interesting. Also, he graduated in physics, and he made also important contribution to theoretical, what we call now theoretical physics. But then there was obvious consequence. There are many, many chairs on mathematical physics because rational mechanics and mathematical physics were important courses in the university. So it was necessary to have many people. And of course, you cannot find always Vito Volterra or Levi Civita, Castelduo, Enriquez, and so on. So that the field, on the average, the field was quite depressed in the sense that there were some old problems in the 19th century that were studied and studied again, Coster-Hanno fluids and so on. So that most of the research in mathematical physics in the 20s and the 30s was not a very high level. I mean, forgotten Volterra, Levi Civita, and so on. They are. Then there was an important event. I think has not been studied in a careful way, and it is very, very important. In 1926, there was a competition, in Italy, national competition for a chair in Cagliari in mathematical physics. There were many, I mean, the rule at that time were the following. So there were the applicants, then there was a committee. The competition was for one chair, but the committee produced a list of three people who were good to have the chair, and they gave the order, first, second, and third. It was perfect. The committee was made of five people, and the three could get this. So among the applicants, there was Enrico Fermi, 26. Enrico Fermi was very, very smart, very, very good at the time. Physics, like, for example, I see the connection is unstable. You tell me whether.
Yes, can you start again? That you said
important
that. Sorry, yes.
One of the competitors was Enrico Fermi. He had a very, very good production in mathematical physics. He had juvenile papers in quite young age, very, very good in mathematical physics. For example, you have important contribution to general relativity, to electromagnetism, to dynamical systems. So he was a very, very good candidate. The chair was Italian. The committee surely was favorable because Vito Volterra and Tullio Levi Civita was there. They were the strongest persons in mathematical physics. Everybody would have done what they would have asked. And there were the other three people, good, but I mean, the old mathematical physics, so to speak. When they arrived to the decision, they were very, very, they would immediately agree on the three people who would be in the winning triplet, first, second, third. Then the problem was to choose the first, then the second, then the third. And there was a split. I have analyzed this, and it is very, very deep fact that there was a physicist, Giovanni Giorgi, who was the inventor of the MKS system of units, which is still exploited. He was very good, but it was quite connected to all the world. Consider that Giorgi took the laureate degree in physics at the time when Fermi was born, so it was more than 20 years old. At the end, the committee, I mean, this is with the vote of 3-2, the two were Volterra and Levi Civita, voted that the first would be this Giovanni Giorgi, the second Enrico Fermi, and the third Rocco Sirini, who was good, but I mean, was the third. The chair was in Cagliari, so it looks like Volterra and Levi Civita were defeated, essentially, because they were 2-3. So Giovanni Giorgi went to Cagliari. He stayed. Cagliari, you know, is on the island in Sardinia, and you have to make a long, long trip by boat to go to Sardinia. And it looked for some months, it looked like, I mean, the other two people could be called in other universities if there was a position. For some months, it seemed there were no positions, so that at the end, Orsomare Corbino, the director of Rome, said, okay, so we make a new competition for full professor, but this time it will not be in mathematical physics, it would be in theoretical physics. And here, of course, Fermi won. This was end of 27. So at the beginning of 26, at the beginning of 27, Enrico Fermi was the first chair in theoretical physics in Italy. This is what is told, but the problem for academicians, especially very, very good academicians like Orsomare Corbino, is to have more position in order to have more people on the position. With this trick of making a new competition, they lost one position in mathematical physics because Fermi was the second. But they could earn 3 more positions in total, so it was good, so they could they could let other people win. So it was very, very good. But as a matter of fact, Fermi could have been easily called to mathematical physics. It was necessary to have to have a new chair in mathematical physics, but for Corvino and Levi-Civita and Volterra were in the faculty of Rome, it would be very, very easy. Fermi would have gone to mathematical physics, and what was the consequence? The consequence was that theoretical physics was an answer, and you can see. Even now, theoretical, what is theoretical physics in Italy? And surely it was merit of this big exploit at the beginning. But mathematical physics lost Fermi, and so it was left in a bad position, which is still is felt, felt now. So. This is one should think about that. Mathematical physics was made weaker because Fermi could not get a chair in mathematical.
But so, despite that, in physics there were quite a lot of researchers that were interested in mathematical aspects, like, I don't know, Gallavotti, Ion Alassini.
No, no, I'm talking about the end of 27, so that this was, the point is the following, Fermi was not a professor in theoretical physics, in mathematical physics, so he could not develop the proper field from academic point of view, so to participate to the commissions in the in the committees for professorship and so on. Then many people in mathematical physics were involved in the racial laws, even Volterra and Levi-Civita. Volterra during the racial laws was not hit because he was already put outside because he did not subscribe the oath in favor of the fascist regime in 31, so he was put in pension. But Levi-Civita, who was victim of the racial laws, so he was put in pension. So that at the end, the field that enormous heat, and the mathematicians would like to have the chairs lost by the racial laws would go to mathematics, in particular to mathematical physics, so there was a lowering of the level. So that we arrive even at the end of the, even during the 60s, we are talking about this. Consider that Francesco Calogero, one of the main theoretical physicists in Italy since a long, long time, in a competition for full professorship, did not go into the winning triplet. 60s, I mean, 60s, Francesco Calogero. Next competitions in the 70s, Francesco Calogero still did not win. And I must say that Sergio Dobrigar did not win, and I'm not very modest, but also I did not win in theoretical physics, in mathematical physics. I won in theoretical physics. So the field was the field in mathematical physics was depressed. You mentioned, of course. Gianni Gallavotti, Sergio Dobrigar, and so on. Okay, Sergio Dobrigar, I tell you, Sergio Dobrigar was one of the persons. Sergio Dobrigar, he organized the famous papers with the Hag, Dobrigar, Roberts, and so on. He was the authority in quantum field theory. He participated in the 70s, 74. He participated to competition in mathematics. And he lost in mathematical physics and one in theoretical physics. There is a connection.
It's okay. Sorry, yes, okay. But can you move your hand from the mic? Sorry. Yes, thank you.
Ah, because there is a rumor. Okay. So Doppler, still, now he's emeritus, but he still is a professor of theoretical physics, not professor of mathematical physics. There was, this is a perception. In the competition Cagliari 71, Cagliari, already Sardinia, Cagliari 71, Giovanni Gallavotti was among the applicants. So he made application and surely it was clear that the traditional mathematical physicist would have considered him. Fortunately, there was one mathematical physics, open-minded, Salvador, this is, was his name, who was very friend of Giovanni Gallavotti, of course. Giovanni Gallavotti was able to explain to him, look, this, not Giovanni Gallavotti, I mean, Gianfausto dell'Antonio. Gianfausto dell'Antonio was able to explain to his friend Salvadori in the committee that Giovanni Gallavotti was very, very, very good, that he did important research, you know, on the statistical mechanics. He solved an important problem in the Ising model at the end of the 60s. He was co-worker of Salvador Miracle Solé in Marseille. And Salvador was convinced that the papers, of course, were there. So that at the end, Giovanni Gallavotti succeeded in a big enterprise, which Fermi was unable to succeed. He won a position for professor in mathematical physics. So that at the end, Gallavotti at the end was a professor in of mathematical physics in Rome. I mean, why he was not interested in, because that time, I mean, he was interested in statistical mechanics and dynamical systems. So he was in a completely different fields. He worked also in quantum field theory, the renormalization group. So the position of the mathematicians toward the theory of Parisi was extremely, they did not know, mostly of them did not know anything. I tell you that after I gave a talk, I don't remember where, of course, I made some mention at the end, mathematician asked me, but it is true that this student of yours, Giorgio Parisi, is so good, because I mentioned Parisi, so I mean, of course, it was ridiculous. They did not understand the replica trick is so deep, so profound. And replica trick is not run according to conventional mathematics, that mathematicians did not. I mean, if you read even the book by Michel Talagrand is a great mathematician, he gave a great contribution to the understanding of the Parisi solution, to the understanding of ultrametricity and so on. But he said that, for example, replica trick is not worked unless for the end results, which is not a result only at the end there is ansatz, which was made by Parisi. So there was no good understanding of the mathematicians toward the Parisi theory, either because they were interested in other things, the good ones, like Fosso dell'Antonio, for example, of Giovanni Gallavotti, All Rome School of Mathematical Physics was directed toward statistical mechanics, dynamical systems, ergodic theory, and so on. Many, many, many good people. And here, of course, it would be necessary to say other things, that the scientific formation of Giovanni Galeotti is in physics, not in mathematical physics. And maybe people do not know, you know, in the 60s, there was an important school between Florence and Rome, with Raul Gatto and Nicola Capipo, who were involved in elementary particle physics, not using quantum field theory, you know, the Capipo angle. And Galeotti was one of them, together with other good people of the Roman School of Theoretical Physics. Very few people know that Giovanni Galeotti, one of the first jobs in his life, was to teach nuclear physics, temporary job of professor in nuclear physics. At the end of the 60s, many people like Giovanni Galeotti, other people, Brunello De Rozzi, Maria Pulvirenti, Boldrighini, many, all school of mathematical physics in Rome, most of them did belong to this Gatto Capipo school, Gatto, Raul Gatto. They were called the Gattini, which is small cats, Gattini, Gatto, Gattini. Among them, Galeotti, but they went away and built a big structure by themselves. Mathematical physics, this branch of mathematical physics is important. So you could not have interest from this side.
So, sorry.
Other people were interested, in particular, I was very, very interested. I began to think and trying to give some result rigorous from a mathematical point of view. At one point in the 60s, I began to think that there was nothing to do, that it was only game based on physical intuition and the numerical simulation. But then there was important, the Russian school, the Soviet school, Leonid Pasteur, important mathematician in Soviet Union, end of the 80s. He came to Rome, invited by Giovanni Iannola Senior, and he spoke about spin glasses. In particular, he proved, gave us the proof on the blackboard of important theorem that if the overlap order parameter is self-averaging, then necessarily the solution of the spin glass should be the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick replica symmetric solution, which is, of course, we know that it is wrong, not completely wrong, but it is wrong. But it was possible to give a rigorous proof. You start from assumption, order parameter is self-averaging, then you end up with the free energy given by Sherrington-Kirkpatrick. Rigorous mathematics, and then I understood that it was possible to study spin glasses, in particular the solution in rigorous mathematical terms, and so I was involved. I will not tell in detail my involvement, which was very, very complicated and very painful. To give results, it was not so easy. Even though at the end my results were extremely important, it was difficult to put them together. Okay, so we.
That's exactly what I wanted to be pivoting with. So you said towards late 80s, maybe Pasteur visited and gave a talk in Rome that
Who?
you,
Who?
but
Who?
Leonid Pasteur.
Pasteur gave it. Now I do not remember exactly, but it was there was a still Soviet.
Okay.
So it was before 91.
Yeah, because
1891.
So if we look at your publication trail, right, up until 1991, you were organizing a workshop where no one from the spin glass community is present. And within a few months of that, you submit your first preprints on spin glasses. So you've mentioned a couple of elements that made you realize that maybe there's something you could provide. So Pasteur, you said
the workshop I organized, I think, is Pontignano 92, if I remember correctly. Pontignano 92. This was strongly Rome-centered mathematical physics. So many, many people from Rome were invited. And it was really mathematical physics in Rome. So all people. I was invited around the same time by Albeveria. And then I began to talk about the spin glass. In particular, I gave, I believe it's the simplest proof, now I am unstable.
Yes, good. She said you were invited, gave a simple proof, and then?
A simple proof of the fact that the Parisi formula should be involved in the solution. I still did not know how to find the order parameter, but that the Parisi formula was involved. This is quite a rigorous proof, lacking the fact that today it would have been necessary to prove that really it was. But the general structure of the free energy for spin glasses was of this Parisi kind. I mean, of course, it was a frame result. So, because at that time I could not give the variational principle. I could not prove any property of the variational principle. So in any case, it gave a great satisfaction to me because I had the idea that I was on the good track, that Parisi order parameter was really, from a general point of view, I mean, without using any physical intuition, which I could not provide in a very strong way, without using any computer simulation, which I am completely unable to do, but just looking at the shape of the so-called marginal free energy. So it's the change in free energy when you go from a system to slightly larger system, so from n sites to n plus one sites, this marginal necessarily has the structure invented by Parisi. This is I consider this is an important result, even though I did not give too much emphasis only in this conference, in Lugano conference, I gave an account.
I wanted to understand. So who else was working on providing rigorous results for spin glasses in that period? So you mentioned Pasteur, and then probably there was Eisenman.
Shcherbina. Pasteur and Shcherbina in Soviet Union. I say Soviet Union, not Ukraine. They were in Kharkov. No, in Italy also there were people. For example, Brunello di Rozzi was working actively on neural network at the time. Scacciatelli, for example, another people of the Rome mathematical physics of the Rome group gave some results. I would say even important mathematicians like Procesi, for example, Claudio Procesi, who is an important Italian mathematician, now he's emeritus, of course, in Rome. And he gave nice results on neural networks. So it was, of course, Rome was important. There was also Daniel Amit, of course, was Rome at that time.
But I was thinking more specifically to the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model, so to spin-glass model. So not many people were trying seriously to prove something.
It was considered a too difficult problem. And many, many people, especially on the mathematical side, did not grasp the relevance of complex character of the model. Because if you understand the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick, then in few time you will understand neural network, the KSAT problem, hard optimization, essentially. It is a problem of hard optimization, which is a main problem now in science and in applied science. I mean, there are people, very, very strong people like Andrea Montanari, Zecchina, for example. These are people who work in hard optimization, and they study extremely interesting concrete problems, very, 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 very difficult. So, and Sherrington-Kirkpatrick is inside this, and it will be. It is a paradigm, like Ising model in ferromagnetism. Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model is the kind of Ising model in spin glass and the complex systems.
So the fact that you could start demonstrating rigorous results on DSK model. What was the response of the community, both the physics community or the theoretical physics and the mathematical physics community, and even the mathematical, the pure mathematics community? Was there some interactions?
I received some invitations in many important meetings by mathematicians, but to have a response in the direction of studying those problems the fact that with the people like Parisi, Virasoro, Mesar, Daniel Amit, and so on in the field, there was no hope to. So No, I received invitation even by the physicists and by the mathematicians. But okay, and history is complicated.
That's why we're asking history. You, right? so the
it's complicated. You know, still I do not completely understand the consequence of the fact that Enrico Fermi was not called as professor of mathematical physics, but was called as professor of theoretical physics. There is a big difference from academic point of view, because mathematical physics is a course in the university which asks for many, many, many positions. Many, many positions. Theoretical physics began became a big enterprise because it was strictly, in modern times, it was strictly connected with the big accelerator, the CERN. I mean, the power of theoretical physics at CERN in connection with the big accelerator is important. And also here in L, in the LHC, you see that most theoretical physics does work for understanding the results and try to guess new results. But in teaching in the 30s, the positions in theoretical physics were very, very considered. At Fermi, the competition of Fermi was in 26, so he became a professor on January 1st, 27 in Rome. There were three positions, so there were other three winners. Enrico Persico, who at the end went to Florence, Turin, and then Rome. And the other winner was Aldo Pontremoli, who was a very, very good physicist in Rome. And you know that he liked to adventure, so that he participated to the Italia expedition on the North Pole, organized by Umberto Nobile. And the expedition was very successful from a point of view, but they crashed on the ice on the pole. And Pontremoli was very, very unlucky, because when the machine went down, most of the people was thrown away and landed on the back. At the end were some after 1 or 2 months were rescued. It was terrible. Pontremoli was left on the machine, so that the wind brought them away, and it is not known what happened. So this was in 28, was a big disaster. The expedition was successful, but the
cost was high.
The machine was lost, and the animal died. So there was also a big problem with the traditions, with the fascism and so on. It is interesting history, because it is strictly connected to scientific research. It was this enterprise to the North Pole was also a scientific enterprise, studying cosmic ray, the magnetic field, the electric field in the atmosphere. Pontremoli was involved in measuring electric fields in the atmosphere. Maybe we now are able to find one of the instruments that were there and survived the crash, because they went down the back, were not. Okay, this is interesting history, the Italia expedition to North Pole by Umberto Nobile, where Aldo Pontremoli was involved, and Aldo Pontremoli was one of the three winners with Enrico Fermi.
So if you allow us to move back to the 1990s.
Yes.
So should I understand then that the main impact of you getting results, demonstrably correct results about the SK model, was to motivate you to keep working on it at the start? Is that... That's what convinced you to.
Of course, even in the 8, I knew that it was a very, very important problem. Because, first of all, the model is so beautiful that if one writes the few formulae for the Sherrington Kirkpatrick at the beginning, hitting so how stupid they were, I will be able to solve it in a few hours. Then you begin to work and you see how it is difficult, because there are so strong fluctuations everywhere that they are controlled only because of thermodynamics, which makes, it is a connection between probability theory and the thermodynamics in a very deep sense, because what is involved Yeah, it's disorder. It's not a Boltzmann view, so to speak. It is the system works in highly disordered landscape, which gives stronger fluctuations to everything. And these fluctuations have to be controlled. There must be some self-averaging, like strong low or large numbers, but non-linear. I mean, it is complicated. It is very complicated. So in the 80s, surely I knew that it was important important problem, but was difficult. Between the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, there was this visit of Leonid de Pasteur in Rome, where I could see that it was possible to give rigorous results. So I said, okay, so I must give you something. And in fact, then it was very, very nice, because I worked on the reasons of the Parisian representation. I worked on the reason of ultrametricity with the so-called de Guirlande-Guerra relations. Then I found the bound so that Parisi solution at least is a bound. And then we solved also a problem which looks simple, to prove that the infinite volume limit when the system becomes very large does really indeed exist. Many physicists think I don't know that I have to prove it, because of course if the model is interesting, it must have infinite volume limit, because there must be free energy. When the system is very, very large, it should not change if it change free energy per volume. Should not change when I change a little bit. So also we gave this result. And now I'm strongly involved in the replica trick, because many mathematicians think that it's not rigorous, but I am trying to show that it is as rigorous as possible, so that Parisi found differently, not through rigorous mathematical proofs, but in any case, either a result is true or a result is not true. The fact that there is a rigorous mathematics does not mean Parisi found.
So was your goal from the start to prove the validity of the replica trick, or does this develop as you were?
Replica trick is very complicated, because it is a philosophy more than it is a paradigm. If you like, I tell a few things about the replica trick. Few things. Okay, so we take this spin glass system. From a physical point of view, there are two variables characterized. The spin variables would fluctuate according to Boltzmann, so to speak, in this environment. And the environment, the quenched, called the quenched noise, from a physical point of view, is a noise which evolves at a very, very, very long time. So that in first approximation, you make a kind of so like the adiabatic approximation for the chemical bond, so that you say they are fixed, they are random, but fixed. And then, so they are random but fixed. So you study the thermodynamics of the spin variables, trying usual things that is in the case. Firstly, the extensive, intensive, like free energy per volume, the internal energy, the entropy, and so on. Then you will study the fluctuations. Then you will study spin correlations and so on. Now there is a way to connect. This is quenched, so to speak. So the external noise is fixed but random. Quenched, does not participate to thermodynamic equilibrium. You can make an approximation so that the quenched variable will participate to the thermodynamic equilibrium. You have a completely different free energy. And clearly there is a bound, because in the quenched case, you have a average, quenched average of log Z is less or equal to the log of the average of Z. The average of Z is called annealed, annealed because the variable participated to thermodynamic equilibrium. There is a strong metallurgical terminology for good reasons. Then there is this idea of replica. What is a replica? A replica of the system is not the physical copy, because if you have one system and you make a physical copy, if the system is disordered, the physical copy will be disordered with a different disorder. There are two different systems. But instead, we talk about replicas. So it is a system which has different sigmas, because it is a different system, which evolve, but the noise is the same in two systems, so replica. From a physical point of view, of course, nothing will change, because if you take the log and so on, for a copy of the system, the log of the product will be the sum of the log, and you have the same thing. But when you take the annealed average, then the annealed average of replicas, so you take z to the s integer, z to the s. The annealed average has nothing to do with the product of the annealed averages. For the quenched average is the same, of course. But the annealed average are very, very different. Annealed averages of replicas are quite easy to study. You can study even in the infinite volume limit, the average of Z, one over n volume log of the average of Z, or one over n log of the average of Z to the second power, Z to the third power, and so on. And the average of Z to the second power is not the average of Z, or is not the square of the average of Z, of course. So you have the quenched, the annealed averages are all different. They can be studied. There is industry. I mean, there is some work to do everything here in a recursive way, but it can be done. Now, what is a replica trip? It's very, very deep, very, very deep. There is the idea, I mean the illusion, if you like, that if I know the quenched averages in the infinite volume limit of the for any number of replicas, n equal one, n equal two, and so on, then I know everything. In particular, I can consider the average at zero replica. If you have one over n log of average of z to the n, when n goes to zero, this is the same as the average of log of z, so that you have that. I mean, I talk in general, not for you, of course. You have that knowing the averages, the quenched averages, when the number of replicas goes to zero, you have the annealed averages. So when n goes to zero, you find the quenched average, which is the physical object, of course. So essentially, how knowing the averages, the annealed averages for integer number or replica, how to build the analogous expression when the number of replicas go to zero. So if only you consider this problem, then mathematicians will be lost. But as a matter of fact, it is perfectly all right, because if you know Z, then Z to the S, I call S in general, the replicas, Z to the S has a meaning not only when S is integer, but in general. Of course, when S is integer, you can calculate it explicitly. In general, you have the expression, you can find infinite volume limit, and essentially you can find also the solution. So replica trick is the pretension, the idea to study the case of zero replicas knowing integer replicas. And this is okay. So, well-defined problem. It is known also in elementary particle physics, because if you think, for example, of some analytic continuation, if you know the function of on the integers, of course, there are many analytic continuations. But in the replica trick, in the Parisian replica trick, there is also another ingredient with younger people in general undervalue, that to find this limit, so to speak, toward the zero replica, one has to make an ansatz, which is the ultrametric ansatz by Parisi. And then by making this ansatz, you have the Parisi formula, and so. So of course, my attempt is completely different. I do not make analytic continuation, but I work on the expression. I try to find, with respect to the number of replicas, a kind of phase transition such that when the number of replicas becomes less, number of replicas real, not integer, then there is a phase transition, and so on. So I hope to give interpretation, so to speak, of the replica trick, not based on analytic continuation, but based on what I call interpolation, in the sense that you consider z to the n with an integer, you can consider also z to the s with s any real number, and study it. It is a real challenge, because if you do this, you can apply many other cases where, for example, for the case of neural network or multi-species models, where there are many different sites, different kind of sites interacting, like the bipartite speed model and so on. It is not completely clear what is the Parisi formula, but one can easily write the expression in general using this interpolation. Oh, okay, so it is.
So during your time, I'm sorry, were you gonna? So I was gonna say, so during your time at La Sapienza as a professor or elsewhere, did you ever get to teach courses on replica symmetry breaking or the replica trick? Yeah. And if yes, in what context?
Because I was called to Rome in 79. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was a professor of theoretical physics, of course. I was called to Rome, and Giovanni Gallavotti, Sergio Dobliker were minded so efficient to convince people to call me in the mathematics department, Mathematics Institute. At the time it was Mathematics Institute. Because the Physical Institute was toward elementary particle physics. I see connection is unstable. Do you hear me? Do
yes.
you hear me?
It's good.
Yeah, okay. So I was obliged to take chair in theoretical physics, not in mathematical physics. And so I was professor of statistical mechanics. And for 33 years, from my call to Rome to my retirement, I gave a course in statistical mechanics with the program always changing the program. So that I could speak about problems of Euclidean field theory, of statistical mechanics, infinite volume limit, and so on. And in the last years, I also considered the problem of a complex system, all theory, the structure of replica symmetry breaking. I mean, I had many good students because I was lucky that my course was not compulsory. So that there were around 10 students, but all research students oriented. So consider that I had the students, Pierluigi Contucci, who is now professor in Bologna, Stefano Ghirlanda, who is now professor in New York. Many, 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 many good people, even with good recognition, participated to this course. And so in particular, I show the infinite volume limit, the Parisi solution, the how to deal with these objects, essentially from a rigorous point of view, but I speak rigorous mathematics only if it is simple mathematics. Each step must be simple, single step. Then the complexity comes from the fact that all steps are put together.
So you would have...
I was only in last year, so my teaching, I was near to retirement.
Okay.
I was very upset because they made my course compulsory in some study plans. It was compulsory, and I found 40 students of mathematics who did not know nothing about anything. And so the course was, also there was a change in the law. So at the end I was told that I was making too difficult a course and I should make a difficult, much simpler. I was told that I was teaching too much and I should teach less. Okay.
So I understand that you taught roughly the mathematics of the replica trick from, would it be fair, from the mid-90s to 2005? Is that roughly the good bounds or?
I would say, no, till the end.
Till the end, okay.
Okay. Yeah, till 2000, I left in 2030.
Okay.
And I was beginning during the 90s. Yes.
Okay. So
some arguments. I think I had also some impact because many, many people in the field attended some of my lectures. Many, many people, even the people not involved in mathematical methods and so on.
So is there anything else you'd like to tell us about this era that we might have skipped over, do you think are important aspects?
No. I think I told everything that I wanted to think. I apologize that I put something connected with the 20s and the 30s, but I think it's important because all what happens now, especially in Italy and in Rome, has its source in Fermi and Majorana So the 30s are the essential part. If you look at the papers by Majorana, even Ferri, but especially Majorana, they are really very, very good papers in mathematical physics in the modern sense, so connected with the phenomenology. And Majorana method is really interesting. He wrote a lot of things on the method, which is not very well known, because of course everybody knows Majorana and Greenough. But he was interested in the method, especially in connection with the important scientists in his family, who knew that the method was important. Of course, they were scientists in sociology, in economy, in law, and so on, but they were high level expert in the complex system. I think that history is important, especially for mathematics and physics in Italy and in Rome, because there is development. You can find that people speak and other people will understand and will give other contributions and so on.
Now, I'm extremely grateful that you brought those connections. This is a very singular perspective that you have, so it's extremely helpful for us to hear as well. And in that spirit, in the spirit of history, have you kept notes, paper, correspondence from those years? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
This is it's important questions. I will tell you one example. You know, there is a kind of model of Spinglass, a simplified model, which is the random energy model. And this has been developed by Bernard Derrida. Very important model, because it is a kind of laboratory. If you have an idea about something and you would like to know whether it works, you do not try Shelton Kirkpatrick model. First, you try the Derrida random energy model. Okay. So it's important, simplified model, but there are thousands of papers dedicated to it. Even I write a replica trick with my interpretation in the random energy model and so on. Now, I was told by Parisi that the random energy model was introduced by Nicola Gabibbo. Nicola Gabibbo is an important theoretical physicist in the 70s. Independently from Sheridan and Kirkpatrick. Gabibbo did not publish it because he is a very ambitious theoretical physicist, of course. And so he thought that it was too simple, did not publish. It would be very interesting to find among Gabibbo papers. There are a lot of papers, notes, correspondence, and so on, whether there is something related to this. Of course, things are more difficult because many years ago, I asked Nicola Gabibbo, it was already very, very ill, but nevertheless, very good relations. So I asked him about this episode, but he could not remember exactly. So shall we find notes of Nicola Gabibbo about the random energy model? I would be very pleased, of course. In any case, our department has the tradition to keep all papers of people who go to pension or like Fermi go abroad, so that we have the papers by Gabibbo. Still, there is no complete catalog. And no people studied then. But we have everything, so that a at the end, we will have also notes by Giorgio Parisi. Is there is a tendency to keep the notes even for living people. For example, Luciano Maiani, who gave important contributions to elementary particle physics, he left his notes, all the notes, in the archive of the department so that you can study how this flavor of physics developed in the understanding of Luciano Maiani. I think we must preserve the memory. I mean, I think this is exactly more or less the right time, January, to remember what is the meaning of preserving the memory. We must preserve the memory in the good and, of course, tragedies. Is what they made our history very, very.
And what about your own papers and correspondence? Is it being preserved? I understand.
I have everything. I moved the office many, many times, and I kept everything. Many things I have at home, but I think that they will study. I have letters by Arthur Whiteman, Tullio Reggio, Jean Fossel, Antonio, of course, Edward Reniel, many, 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 many people. I have a lot of material, and I kept all notes. When I read them after many, many years, in some cases I do not understand anything, but with some effort, you understand the development of ideas. So I kept everything, and I mean, the people in the archives told me, why you do not give something to us? I am Neapolitan, so I told this not a good idea, but in some years they will get everything. So I have also the opportunity to make a kind of a treasury, some boxes where the most relevant things. I found the work done in Princeton 1970, 71, 72 was very important in my life because I gave good results that made my presence, so to speak, in the field, and I have everything preserved. All the problem with respect to Majorana Fermi. Majorana wrote with the ink. So after so many years, the ink is perfect, perfect. You read like, at the time we were used to write with the ballpoint pen. And there is a big problem that ink of the ballpoint pen, according to statistical mechanics, has a kind of diffusion process inside the paper. So that when now you read the notes, you have to make the deconvolution. So it is a convolution, what you had before. Convolution with the Gaussian distribution, which gives the movement of the ink in the paper. So now you have to make a deconvolution, which is like anti-parabolic, solving anti-parabolic, and it is known that it is very unstable because you have to invert e to the minus Gaussian, you have to invert, so to speak, to make a convolution with e to the plus something quadratic, but it is strange. I mean, it is strange, but it looks. If you write by pencil, then other disaster can appear that everything disappears. This we found also in papers by Majorana that in some cases he wrote by pencil, and it is very, very difficult to read it.
On these wise advice, I'd like to thank you very much for your time, Professor Guerra. It was
okay.
Very enjoyable. I will.